Well, greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. Got a lot to get to today. I started off by tweeting a link that was sent to me. I had never heard of this before. Youth targeted Calvinism. Yes, youth targeted Calvinism. SBC Today, always a SBC Today, SBC Voices, always interesting places to, you know, when the insanity of the rest of the world just isn't insane enough for you, there's a place where you can go to find. And so Dr. Rick Patrick, the senior pastor of the First Baptist Church of Sylacauga, Alabama, wrote an article posted today on youth-targeted Calvinism. And just to give you a sense of the depth of the analysis here, Calvin, under the subtitle, An Angry God, Calvinism is associated with Neo-Puritanism. Obviously, Calvinism predated Puritanism, but anyways, we tend to view the Puritans as peaceful people who dressed modestly and made friends with the Indians. I'm sorry. But Calvinist Puritan Cotton Mather's is certainly the most infamous leader responsible for the Salem witch trials. And Calvinist Puritan Jonathan Edwards best articulated the view that God's disposition is primarily angry. I'm sorry. It's just so painfully obvious that Dr. Patrick... Okay, have you ever read Jonathan Edwards? Do you understand why those of us who have read large swaths of Edwards, in fact, I think one of the reasons I have to have my really cool progressive lens glasses today is because of those two books over there with the red, the fourth and fifth from the left are the works of Jonathan Edwards, the Banner of Truth two-volume micro print. I mean, like you can put half a book on a page. All right. Those of us who have actually read Edwards, more than just a sermon by Edwards, but like entire books by Edwards. In fact, maybe some of his not so famous books. You know what word that even Edwards fans and admirers eventually get so sick and tired of that you just want to eat really salty chips for an hour? Sweet. The Edwards used the term sweet so often that in all modern published versions of Edwards' works, there is a warning to all diabetics prior to reading the book. And they come with a little syringe of insulin. I mean, that's how often he uses the term sweet. If you think that Sinners in the Hands of Angry God is exhaustive, Jonathan Edwards, sir, you are as ignorant as the day is long of Jonathan Edwards. And in light of something else that happened after the last program, why is it that people get on the internet and think that they can comment about stuff they know absolutely positively nothing about, including even commenting about what people said that they didn't listen to? What is this? I mean, the world's gone nuts. It really, really has. So anyways, it continues on. In his best-known work, Edwards wrote, "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of pure eyes and to bear you in his sight. You are 10,000 times as abominable in his eyes as the most hateful venomous serpent is in ours." You know what? He said that. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts, Pastor Patrick. I looked around. I did a little, just a little digging around. Dr. Patrick, sorry. I this is really bad for someone who has an earned doctorate in something. I bet you I could find three or four sentences in a row that I could put together and completely misrepresent you too.
Yeah.
While it is granted that God pours out his wrath upon... This is one of the reasons that some of us honestly wonder if SBC Voices, SBC Today, if these may not sort of be onion type sites, you know, where, you know, it sometimes makes you wonder if maybe we're doing the onion thing, because it's hard to tell on the net. It really is at times, but this one would sort of give you an idea. While it is granted that God pours out his wrath upon sin and unrepentant sinners will surely burn in hell, Edwards paints the picture of a monstrously capricious deity for whom the saying of kumbaya, my lord, on a youth group campout seems wildly out of place. it's really published, man. It's right there. Get it before it disappears. I wonder if there's such a thing as youth-targeted Arminianism. No, there's no. It's youth-targeted traditionalism. That's what... Traditionalism. It's amazing that these guys actually want the term traditionalist. That's just shocking to me. But anyways, I tweeted that out, and a lot of you have commented on it and went, really? Seriously? And I go, yeah, really? Seriously, it's actually there. Hey, week from today, I will be in South Africa, Lord willing. And we have a schedule up. We put it up today. You were probably getting as many complaints as I was. That we didn't have a schedule up. And so I guess that's why it ended up being posted today. But on Friday, October 9th, and it's not quite Friday, October 2nd in South Africa, but no, it is. Yes, it is. I think it's 9 hours. So, yep, it's midnight. Is it really? Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's midnight there. So, a little over a week from now, I am going to be engaging Graham Codrington. And if you go to GrahamCodrington.com, I think it is, you can watch a bunch of videos, none of which have anything to do with this, but you will see that Graham is a fine-looking gentleman. Will certainly win the cool-looking suit. I'll be wearing a bow tie, so I'm not even competing. That's just sort of a... Just to let you know ahead of time. I don't want people to be, you know, sitting there the whole time not listening to what we're saying because they're trying to figure out who's the better dressed person. So I'll get rid of that problem right from the start. I don't even know if he could rock a bow tie. He may show up with one now. Anyway, I'll bring an extra one for you, Graham, if you want one. I get it back though. But you have to tie it. That's There's the tough part. Anyway, Grace Point Church, Duncan Road, Midrand, 2191 South Africa. We will be debating the subject of homosexuality. I'm not even sure exactly what the specific focus is going to be yet. I am thankful that Mr. Codrington has been posting on his website a series of articles that has certainly given me a good idea. I mean, it seems fair. I've published a book and I've done, I don't think Dr. Les's bow ties are back in style. Well, with some people. you know, it's obvious, it would be very easy for Graham to know where I'm coming from. There are a lot of people who are just sick and tired of hearing what I have to say on the subject, but 5 hours in response to Vines, 5 hours in response to Gushy, a published book, number of debates. Pretty easy if you want to. If you want to know where I'm going to be coming from, what my bibliology is, what my understanding of the canonical witness from Genesis on is in regards to God's creative purpose, the role of men and women, the fact that God differentiated between them, and there is a purpose for that, all that kind of stuff. It's easy. I'm very thankful that Graham, he hasn't finished the series. And some of the stuff coming up would be helpful because he hasn't gotten to his comments on Matthew 19 yet. But he did, on the 21st, get to Romans 1. So he's done all the Old Testament stuff and basically takes what I have identified as a radical New Covenant theology perspective. And that is, there is not a single law in the Old Testament relevant to us today. Period. End of discussion. Move on from there. Now, I spent a lot of time getting to that point. But all of the work that has been done down through the years demonstrating, you know, in modern terminology, the intertextuality of 1 Corinthians 5 with Leviticus 18 and things like that. Out the door. Fundamentally, the reason that Leviticus 18 and 20 is irrelevant and does not tell us anything about God's view of homosexual behavior is because it's in the Old Testament. Cultic has only to do, is no more relevant than mixed fibers. So all the work that I've done, I'm not breaking any ground, but just simply demonstrating the fact that you can, in fact, look at the Old Testament law, place it in its context, read its original languages. Graham went to seminary, so he's not ignorant of these things. All of that stuff just thrown out the window. So obviously we. Even though he says he came from a conservative Baptist Reformed background, which would seem that we would have a lot in common, in reality, our understanding and view of things very, 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 very different. And so we get to Romans 1, and I will admit that a new argument was presented. I had not run into this one before. I mean, there are so many ways around Romans 1. You know, generally, you know, I've got James Brownson queued up here. We'll get back into his stuff on Romans 1, but I had never encountered this one before. Never run into this one before. It's a new one. And we'll see how you might respond to it here. Let me just read. He provides very kindly a summary before each article, so you can sort of get into it a little bit faster. Romans 1 is the heart of the discussion about gay marriage, as Paul appears to appeal to a natural law that has been in place since creation. The plain reading of Romans 1 makes it clear that Paul has in mind people who have taken their sexuality, and this is his understanding, their sexuality to excess and gone against nature, descending to sexual depravity. This does not describe LGBT people seeking a lifelong monogamous covenantal relationship. Now, I have to stop right here. Yesterday, a day before yesterday, I did a search, because I've taken all of his articles, put them into a PDF file, and I did a search for that phrase. And he doesn't always use all the same words, so I had to search a few times to sort of put them all together. But throughout Graham's work, this phrase, lifelong, monogamous, covenantal relationship, appears over 20 times just in the blog articles, and the series isn't done. And it's always in the context, and obviously this has nothing to do with, and then what you do is you take what your final conclusion is. Because that isn't that what the final conclusion is about? Isn't that what the final conclusion of Graham Codrington's position is that there is such a thing in the Christian faith, despite the utter silence of the Bible, despite the fact there's not a single positive word said about homosexuality, not a single positive word that gives us any indication that marriage could ever be anything other than a male and a female. Despite all of that, the conclusion is that for Christians, lifelong, monogamous, covenantal relationships in marriage are a gift from God. So if that's your final conclusion, that's what you're getting to, Graham Codrington's a brilliant guy. It's Dr. Codrington. I'm not sure what the doctorate's in him, but I saw in his thing it's Dr. Codrington. So this is a smart man. How can you not see when you are constantly inserting the conclusion of your argument into your argument that you are reasoning the circle, that you are assuming what you have yet to prove? Because I reject that there is any such thing, biblically speaking, from a Christian worldview, as a homosexual, lifelong, monogamous, covenantal relationship. The term homosexual destroys the meaning of monogamous and the reason for monogamous. I mean, monogamous, when you think about it, what is monogamous actually referring to? One man, one woman. You're even having to redefine the reason for that. The sexual binary is right there. So monogamous is out the window. Covenantal? Only if you redefine the covenant of marriage as defined in Scripture, which is why I say all the gay Christian movement, every single bit of it, is utterly 1,000% destructive of Christian orthodoxy. It is impossible for gay Christianity to remain orthodox because gay Christianity cannot affirm the sufficiency of Scripture. It's impossible. Can't be done. And time will demonstrate this. Time will demonstrate this. And of course, by the way, all of his sources, Boswell, Brownson, Scanzoni and Mollenkott, Scroggs, Vines, Gushy, complete imbalance. Not even a pretense of even citing the other side. I could pull it up here and do a quick search, but I do not recall a single citation of Gagnon or anybody in response anywhere in all this material. Not even once. Anyway, so it really strikes me as a tremendously strange thing that someone obviously so insightful in other areas, the man speaks all the time on business trends and futurism and all this kind of stuff, travels the world doing it, cannot see that to over and over again say, well, this has nothing to do with my conclusion, which I'm not driving from Scripture at all, which I cannot show you a single shred of evidence would have ever even crossed the mind of an inspired writer of Scripture. I realize that inspired writer is somewhat of a misnomer, but you know what I'm talking about. It really makes me wonder, how does this work? It would be so troubling to me, so very troubling to me, to have to argue in this fashion. And I'm going to tell them that just straight up. I mean, How can you not see what you're doing here? I reject the existence of these things. Here's why I reject. So you can't keep saying, well, it has nothing to do with that. You can't keep reasoning in a circle. And yet, almost every single book that I've read in the past decade does exactly that. So anyway, continuing on the summary here, sorry. The flow of the letter to the Romans is such that the list of sins in Romans 1, listen to this. See how you'd respond to this. Because when I first read this, I was doing the double take thing. Like, huh? I mean, I've heard all about, you know, Brownson and his nature, shame, honor, you know, run over to 1 Corinthians, long hair argument, pederasty, Greek culture, Roman culture. Oh, it's just, you know, every book that comes out has its own, you know, spin on the same stuff. It's never taking Paul seriously. It's never following his argument. It's never following the argument right through Romans 1 and actually starting there. And then it's always this, let's come up with our conclusions first before we ever get to the text stuff. And I've read dozens and dozens of these books since 2000 or so, when Jeff Neal and I were working on the same sex controversy. So, man, it's, wow, 15 years of this stuff. It's old news. But I was expecting, fully expected the nature thing. And I should mention, after this, he posted another article, which I found very, very interesting. Yeah, check this out. I'll scroll up to it. He says, in the previous article of this series, which is the one I'm reading the summary on, I brought together the scholarship of a number of theologians who argue convincingly. Here's an even faster summary, so I'm sort of letting the cat out of the bag. That the letter Paul wrote to the Romans had the goal of unifying Jewish and Gentile Christians. In this context, Romans 1:18-32 is best seen as a discourse familiar to Hellenistic Jews that Paul actually refutes and uses against his readers, especially the Jewish Christians in Romans 2. Never heard that one before, had you? But then check this out. I'll explain more in a second. But then check out this bold type paragraph. I realize that conservative readers may feel that this is too much of a stretch of interpretation. I wish I had an understatement award to provide to Graham here. I want to therefore approach the same text from a more traditional viewpoint and show that even then, bold and italics, this text does not refer to lifelong, monogamous, covenantal, same-gender relationships. But I want to show that it, even though the authors of Scripture could never have allowed for this construction, given their worldview, since they didn't talk about it. I mean, you know, it's like they say they found water on Mars. Let's say we find Martians, and Martians come down here and live amongst us. The Bible never says anything against marrying Martians, and therefore, you know, it's just like, okay. But the point is, he recognizes it's a bit of a stretch. Yeah. It is definitely a bit of a stretch. All right. So, here it is again. The flow of the letter to the Romans is such that the list of sins in Romans 1 is used by Paul to set up his Jewish readers and create a counterpoint which he will use against them in Romans 2 and 3. The list of sins is therefore more about what Jewish people found repulsive in Gentiles than what Paul did. We cannot use this list to focus our attention today on a specific group of sinners. Now think for just a moment. Think of how foundational, fundamental to the Christian worldview Romans 1 is. And you are saying that Paul was actually refuting that. think about the just the absolutely fundamental nature of its discussion of idolatry. The nature of the creator-creation distinction, suppression of the knowledge of God, foundation to apologetics, its incredible insight into the darkening of the mind that suppresses the knowledge of God. All of that, Paul actually didn't believe that. In fact, the single article, one, 21-year-old article from 1994, written by a liberal New Testament scholar that, to my knowledge, nobody in 21 years has expanded upon, accepted, utilized, made foundational to their thinking, this concept. But he found it. And that one single article is the foundation that he provides for this idea. And in that article, yeah, this is he understands what the guy was saying in the article. Problem is, in the article, it says that Paul was deriving this from a Jewish source, but strangely and oddly enough, never tells us what the Jewish source is. Because, of course, it's all hypothetical. There probably was a Jewish source. We just don't know what it was. But Paul was quoting from it, because this isn't really Paul. And this grand insight, never before known in church history until approximately 1994, is what we need to adopt to recognize that Romans 1 and its testimony and its statement about homosexuality is irrelevant to us today. From the literary context, it makes the most sense to see Romans 1, 18 to 32 as a well-known discourse against Gentiles taken from Jewish writings that Paul pulls into his letter. So well-known that no one's ever seen it. This is, by far, by the way, the most desperate attempt I've ever seen. I think that's why he has to continue on, and let's try another one and do the standard nature stuff, you know, natural law, isn't Genesis, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the people that he's quoting, you know, he quotes Matthew Vines. Well, who's Matthew Vines' big source? Brownson? Does Brownson take this view? Completely not. I mean, Brownson is 100% opposed to this. Everything we've listened to him from already on Romans 1, and we'll hear the rest of Romans 1, this is so idiosyncratic. Soteriology 101's readings of some texts in Romans 9 might be as idiosyncratic. In other words, way out there. But, wow. And it is so far out there that I'm awful glad, I'm very thankful that I had the opportunity of reading this. The only thing that concerns me is, will his reading of Matthew 19 be as far out there? Because when you encounter something that is absolutely a historical, exegetical, theological novum, And you know, to come up with a complete novum means you really have to believe that you have an insight that nobody else in the church has ever, 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 ever had. The Reformers did not believe that about themselves, by the way. They really didn't. Their argument was they're restoring something that had been believed long ago and had become encrusted over by Roman tradition. They weren't going, we don't care. No one's ever seen this before. We're much smarter and all that kind of stuff. No. But when you encounter a theological novum, it's one thing to go, really? But that's not really an argument. And it can be a real challenge to come up with a meaningful refutation. I mean, having listened to this now and having been able to think about it, seems pretty obvious. I mean, what basically the article does, and you'll see the bill coming through. I sent you the email, I think. In fact, I think I sent it to you last night. Cost me $30 to buy the article, but got to have it because it's the one thing. It is absolutely the one thing that he depends upon in this particular article. Is this one article that came out in 1994. And so I had to have it. You can get it online too if you want to spend $30 to pick it up. He quotes a lot from N.T. Wright, but believe me, N.T. Wright doesn't take this view either. And in fact would find it, I think, extremely strange. But the guy he's quoting is a fellow by the name of Calvin Porter. And he wrote an article in 1994 on this subject. And basically what he does is he tries to turn this, he draws from a bunch of sources that discuss various forms of Greek rhetoric and tries to shove Romans 1 and 2 and 3 into a particular pattern of Greek rhetoric, which then means that 1:18 through 32 is being set up as a foil. And then when chapter 2 begins and he changes his address, who are you? That this then becomes the big thing. This is the big transitionary moment. And this demonstrates, I mean, to the rest of us and to all of church history and to all Christians that ever come before, it was painfully obvious that Paul was then turning his attention to the Jews, having stated clearly what the Bible itself teaches on the subject of the universal sinfulness of man. And that it is central to his argument that remain in force, because when he gets to his conclusion in chapter 3, he's going to say, we have concluded that all are under sin. Without Romans 1, that makes no sense. The foundation of 1 is continued in 3 and comes to the conclusion in 3. I mean, it just turns the book of Romans into, well, again, if you're trying to revise the entire Christian faith, and that's what you have to do to create quote-unquote gay Christianity, you've got to change the faith. And so the result's going to be destruction all around. And if you have to end up destroying Romans, well, you know, okay, I guess we just get to destroy Romans. But that, unfortunately, is exactly what is taking place here. All right, so I'll go back to the summary in case I haven't explained it well enough here. In fact, Romans 2, 1 through 5 makes it clear that Paul refutes the statements in Romans 1, 18 through 32 and sees them as part of the problem and shows that God is against anyone who thinks this way about the Gentiles or anyone for that matter. That's not what Romans 2, 1 through 5 is about. I mean, you can make this kind of assertion, but listen to what it says. Therefore, you have no excuse, everyone who you pass a judgment. For in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge, practice the same things. That makes no sense if he's arguing that the previous section is actually wrong. He's talking about hypocrisy. I mean, and we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. But do you suppose this, O man, practice what things? The things of chapter 1. But do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment of those who practice such things, and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Isn't that clear? Or do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and tolerance and patience, not knowing the kindness of God leads you to repentance, but because of your stubbornness and repentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God? He's talking about, he's going to say later on, merely possessing the scriptures, merely possessing the law of God and not doing the law of God does not make you right with God. It's so plain, so obvious, and it is clearly an example. The article by Porter is clearly an example of what you see in a large portion of scholarship, where you're trying to get published, and the idea is you need to come up with something new. And in the Christian faith, there should be a respect for the Word of God and a respect for the generations who have come before us that should moderate and control and restrict the willingness to be this wildly zany with eisegetical foolishness. But it didn't stop Porter. And so now you see the utilization of this by a man who is seeking to promote the redefinition of marriage to the point of the fundamental distortion of marriage, et cetera, et cetera. There you go. There you go. So, anyway, I go back to a good summary of Paul's opening chapters, and in fact, the whole letter to the Romans comes in Romans 14, 13 through 14. Therefore, let us stop passing judgment on one another. Instead, make up your mind not to put any stumbling block or obstacle in the way of a brother or sister. I just have to stop. Complete ignorance of context. Complete. Romans 14 is inter-Christian relationships in regards to disputable things. That is not the context of Romans 1, 2, and 3. At all. This is absolutely what's the term I'm looking for? If you sue somebody, not malpractice, malfeasance. Malfeasance in exegesis is the only way to describe this manhandling of the text. It's horrible. It's shocking. And it, the stuff before this had been pretty standard revisionist stuff. You know, surface level, hyper New Covenant theology stuff, and your standard type of thing. The stuff on Ars Anticoites, again, standard. Even though he recognizes Paul is deriving this straight out of Leviticus 18 and 20, he ignores that. He says, this is where he's getting it from, but then when he finally makes applications of what it actually means, it's not what it means in Leviticus 18 and 20 for some strange, odd reason. So it's not that there hadn't been clues that it could get this bad, but I never expected something like this. So the quotation from Romans 14, totally out of context, completely different context. Finally, the only issue Paul raises that can be transferred to the modern-day issue of same-gender sexuality is an appeal to the nature of things. We will deal with this in the next section of this study, which, of course, is the same thing Brownson is doing and the stuff that we've been reviewing there. So, how would you respond? May I make application, please? Please, may I? May I make an application? I wasn't planning on doing this, but there is a reason why I emphasize the necessity of doing your homework before addressing something. Now, there is a balance here because no one has all knowledge. No one can be prepared for every single objection, statement, position. But in doing apologetics, we try to lay the strongest foundation we can so that when we encounter stuff, we can give a consistently biblical response. But in this situation, thankfully, I'm not going to be facing, at least on this text, a perspective that I've never heard of before. If I had not taken the time, and it takes time, if I had not taken the time to download all these articles, convert them to MP3, listen to them on a long ride yesterday, I had started reading through the material on the flight back and marking things. Hadn't gotten to Romans 1 yet. That was the last article in the... You put all the articles together, it was over 120 pages in PDF formats. Those aren't small pages. Those are large pages. If I had encountered this in a debate, my hope is I could have given a meaningful response. I'll be able to give a much better thought out response, because this is such a fundamental attack upon the consistency of the book of Romans. It is so far outside of the realm of anything that any meaningful scholar has ever come up with before, that it's obviously going to, upon reflection, provide you with numerous examples of how utterly unusable and unworkable the theory is, and how the text itself refutes it. But so many times I've gone into debates with liberals, and they have not even taken the time to Google my name, let alone read anything that I've written. They don't care. It's irrelevant to them. We don't have anything worth listening to. We have nothing meaningful to say to begin with. Nothing meaningful to say. And you've seen some of the results of that. The first debate with Dan Barker, University of Illinois. The debate with Father Peter Stravinskas. They're obviously at a tremendous disadvantage. So it's not just simply a matter of, well, you know, it would be wise to do this because it would give us the advantage in the debate. No, I think there is a truth-honoring issue here that I brought up on the last program that really, I think the internet somewhat minimizes this. I think it has created a culture in which reaction and response is so fast and is expected to be so fast that we have simply traded off depth and consistency for speed and emotion. And some people think that, you know, I'm compromising if I don't utilize all the arguments that could be used against falsehood. Well, I can only use arguments that happen to be true, and that happen to be fair, and that happen to be consistent. And I could have gone into this and said, you know, I've debated this thing so many times, you know, what's he going to have to say? And probably would have held my own. But you see, I'm sitting here going, we're spending lots of money to fly me to South Africa. The folks in South Africa, are giving of themselves to make this happen and to put the effort into organizing these things. And we're going to be videotaping this. You know, we just posted some new videos up online. I put them on Twitter today from earlier in the year. Remember I mentioned the fellow that came up to me while I was in Zurich, and lo and behold, God used debates that we did back when I could still do a comb over pretty well. You know, I still had my 1980s large glasses, the whole nine yards. and used those, even though the video quality back then couldn't be what it is today, still used those in this young man's salvation. So we've been trying to get people like Matthew Vines to step up to the bat and do, you know, David Gushee, you know, he can call us, he can say we're in sin, but he won't defend that. They lack the integrity to back up what they're saying. So here I am, going to South Africa primarily to do three debates in Durban with Muslims there, including another with Ayub Karim, who will be representing the Ahmed Didot perspective on the deity of Christ. That's going to be extremely useful. And two with Yusuf Ismail in the Juma Masjid. Again, tremendous opportunities. But this opportunity came up, and I had a choice to make. I've been pretty busy recently. 2 weeks home after 18 days in the road ain't much. If you travel, you know, you get home. There's all sorts of stuff. You're all behind on all sorts of things. But the Lord's really placed a burden upon my heart to be prepared, especially for this debate. This man's a professional speaker. Professional speaker. And he has spent a lot of time reading revisionist material, a lot of time. And so I am taking him very, very seriously. And thankfully, I did so, because this is an amazing perspective. And in the midst of a debate, first of all, it's going to be extremely important for me. I don't know what the order of speaking is going to be. What if I go first? What if I go first and did not know that he took this perspective? As I prepare my opening statement and dealing with Romans 1, will I not be able to present Romans 1 in a much stronger way now? If I hadn't done this, then I may have been accurate in my handling of Romans 1, but if I don't know that my opponent is basically going to say Romans 1, Paul's refuting that, then I'm only going to be able to respond to that in the shorter and shorter time periods that come afterwards, which means in much, much, much less depth. And if I can make my presentation on Romans 1 demonstrate its absolute necessity of following the flow of thought through, demonstrating he's clearly drawing from the creation accounts, demonstrating that it's in perfect harmony with the Old Testament law, demonstrating that it's in perfect harmony with Romans 2 and 3. Now I can make those points. I can demonstrate the incoherence of the counter-argument before the counter-argument's even made. That's why when I can't, you can't always do this. You simply can't always do this. I mean, I'm pretty confident that I know where Yusuf Ismail is going to go. I'm even more confident I know where Ayub Karim's going to go, because Ayub Karim has basically made the commitment to representing Ahmed Didot. And if I know where any Muslim would go, it's Ahmed Didot. Okay? I've spent too many years listening to Ahmed Didot to not know. And I'm trusting, because Ayub Karim, he very accurately represented Didot last time on the crucifixion. So I'm just assuming he's an honorable individual. He's probably going to do the same thing again. So I know where they're going. Now I've got a good idea. Now, do I know what he's going to say about Matthew? Yeah, Matthew 19, Mark 10. No. It may get posted before then. If it does, I'll certainly read it. I'll certainly read it. But to be perfectly honest with you, I cannot even imagine as radical a reading of Matthew 19 as what is being done here to Romans. I can't begin to understand it. So if you're going to criticize someone, if you're going to engage in debate with somebody, if you can find out exactly what they believe, do so. Don't criticize somebody about what they said on a podcast without listening to it. Hello? Seriously? Wow. Credibility, gun, boom. What? Come on. And you know who I'm talking about, and you should know better. Anyway, so I was going to get on to Brownson here. I've got him all queued up over here. You can't really see him on the screen, but he's in an interesting frozen situation there. But I don't know that we could get enough into his position now to actually do anything there. Unfortunately, wasn't there something? Fish. Since it is on the same relative subject, I guess I should mention this in the last few minutes here. I guess there's a new book coming out. I honestly have to admit, I may leave this one for Michael Brown to deal with. I just don't know that I can bring myself to even buy the Kindle version and drag myself through it. Alan Chambers has written a new book, My Exodus from Fear to Grace. Oh. Now, some of you don't know who Alan Chambers is, but he used to head up Exodus International, which was intended as a ministry to assist people in fighting their homosexual tendencies, feelings, etc., etc. His collapse has been a very well-documented thing. And he has, of course, swung off into apostasy as a result. And so, you know, big headline, Alan Chambers, same-sex relationships can be holy. And new book, My Exodus from Fear to Grace. Now, I really, honestly doubt that there's going to be anything new here other than how do you excuse your apostasy, and how do you excuse the hypocrisy that was your life beforehand? I guess that would be the only new thing. There isn't a reason to believe there's going to be anything new, like Graham Codrington's use of Porter's article or something like that. But I would imagine that he will probably get a fair amount of press off of this, because the press has been extremely happy to have a fallen figure to point to and to point at and to utilize. But there it is. I like I said, I'll drop Michael a note, and maybe we can do rock, paper, scissors as to who has to read it. Because I have a feeling he probably feels pretty much the same way. He's written some articles about Chambers, and both of us probably have the same same ideas about that. Did I mention? I don't think I mentioned this. Did I mention what happened with Lindy West? Oh my goodness. Real quickly, because we only have about 4 minutes left. Remember last week I talked about Lindy West on the program? The Shout Your Abortion woman? Somebody sent her the link, the dividing line. She posted the video on her Twitter feed. Thanks for the ad. Appreciate that, Lindy. Now, of course, she then tweeted me. Somehow she looked up my Twitter ID, tweeted me. The resulting conversation wasn't much of a conversation because she refused to act like an adult human being and demonstrate a capacity to think past about the second grade level. And was just childish. I mean, immature on a level of seriously. I think right now Clementine could probably have taken her on that particular day. And she's not three yet. It was that bad. And of course, she brought with her. Let's just say that that my block feature got used a lot. Because let's just say these individuals like using all sorts of very colorful language. Very colorful language. That's their best way. It was bad, but it was amazing. And for me, you know, okay, I don't like having to block folks, and it's sad to watch anyone who is creating the image of God behaving as a child, so, you know, absolutely given over in their love of their detestation of truth and their love of sin and destruction and just thinking about the destruction of their own lives that they are promoting. But at the same time, I hope and pray that 5, 10 years out, maybe, when did we do those? Mid-90s. So 20 years from now? If I'm still around, maybe I might meet somebody who was influenced by, exposed to the truth because, well, you wouldn't believe this, but I was following this Lindy West and then I saw this video and you never know. Like I said, this webcast, I've ended up, in the past 6 months, I've been on CNN, sitting next to, once sitting next to transgender folks discussing those issues. You never know where this program's going to go. God has a sense of humor sometimes in where this program ends up going, and a sense of humor in what some people think they hear on this program too, which is another issue. But anyway, I forgot to mention that, and it was very, very, very interesting. I don't know what the schedule is going to be. We might be able to sneak a program in next week. The day I fly out, right. I fly out Tuesday evening. That ain't happening. Maybe Monday. We'll see. We'll try. We'll do our best. If not, please pray for the ministry upcoming in South Africa. We'll see you whenever the next time is. God bless.